Shalom, welcome to SJTF. This is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to elevating the souls of Simcha Bat Shlomo, Pesach Ben Dov, Meir Ben Yecheskel, and Yosef Ben Meir. Before we get to our many questions from our great JTFers, I want to speak this week about the election of Rabbi Meir Kahana, Zecher Tzadik VeKadosh Livracha Hashem Yikom Damo, to the Israeli Knesset, to the Israeli Parliament. There are certain facts that people may not be aware of in regard to the election, and I think it's important because we've been speaking lately about how much we really want to run for the Israeli Knesset, well, we really want to run for the Israeli Parliament. We want to run and get people in our movement in Israel elected to the Knesset. I don't know if we're going to be able to do it. The next election should be in about 3 or 4 years. But we very much would like to be able to do that, if possible. And if we can't do it in 3 or 4 years, then maybe the next time. But our goal is really focused now on getting into the Israeli Knesset. And we're going to hopefully be able to explain why that would be so important, why it would be such a significant event, not only for Israel, but also for America and for the Western world. First of all, in 1984, Rabbi Kahana was elected to the Knesset. He won one seat out of 120 seats. At that time, you could get elected winning just one seat out of 120 seats because the minimum threshold for getting in was 1%. If you got 1% of the vote, if you got a minimum of 1% of the vote, you got one seat in the Knesset, which is what he got. He just got barely over 1% of the vote. The new minimum, by the way, now is 2%. So we would have to actually get double what Rabbi Kahana got, because the minimum has been increased to 2% since then. I hope it's not increased even more, and there are proposals to do that, but hopefully it won't be. Right now it's 2%. Now, the first three times that Rabbi Kahana ran for the Knesset, he lost. He ran for the Knesset in 1973, 1977, and 1981, and he lost all three times. And we're going to explain why he lost. The fourth time in 1984, he finally got elected. You know, there's a saying that billionaires have. People who make billions of dollars, who become the biggest, richest, most successful people. They always say the first $1 million was the hardest part. Once I got the first million, it was easy. The rest came a lot easier. But the first million, the first time I had to get my hands on a small fortune so that I could invest and do the things that I have to do to make much more, that was the hardest part. That's what billionaires often tell us. The first million is the hardest. And that's certainly true when it comes to the Kahanists. Rabbi Kahana, three times in a row, could not get elected to the Knesset. And the reason he couldn't get elected, let me tell you why he couldn't get elected. He couldn't get elected because of Menachem Begin. Menachem Begin was so popular among the Mizrahi Sephardic Jews. The Mizrahi Sephardic Jews are the Jews that came from Arab and Muslim and third world countries. They're the generally dark-skinned Jews who live in Israel. They're about 50% of Israel's Jewish population. And those tend to be the most right-wing Jews in Israel. They're the most religious, they're the most right-wing usually. And those were the Jews that loved Rabbi Kahana. But Rabbi Kahana could not get their support because Menachem Begin was running. Menachem Begin was running at the head of the Likud party in 73, 77, and 81, in those three elections where Rabbi Kahana lost. And all the Mizrahi Jews who loved Rabbi Kahana, they loved him, but their first love was Menachem Begin. They wanted a vote for Menachem Begin. Even though Menachem Begin, as a leader, as the Prime Minister of Israel, was a disaster, but they were convinced. You couldn't speak to them about Menachem Begin. They were convinced. And this is a different generation. The new generation already has forgotten about all of this. But the generation then, you could not convince them. I know from my own family. You could not convince them not to support Begin. He was their hero. He was their idol. They loved Menachem Begin. And even the ones that used to cheer Rabbi Kahana, that loved Rabbi Kahana, that used to cry when they saw him, still voted for Menachem Begin. They would not vote for Rabbi Kahana as long as Menachem Begin was running at the head of the Likud party. Then, in the early 80s, Menachem Begin resigned as prime minister and didn't run anymore. In 1984, Yitzhak Shamir was chosen to run at the head of the Likud party. And so Shamir, by the way, was not popular among the Mizrahi Jews, among the Jews of the Mizrahi or Sephardic background. And so in 1984, when Begin was out of the picture, then Rabbi Kahana was able to get enough votes to get past the minimum threshold and to get one seat in the Israeli Knesset. And that was, in 1984. Now, what we see here is Rabbi Kahana had a hard time getting his first seat, not because he wasn't popular, not because his message didn't resonate, not because there weren't a lot of people who didn't love him, but because a small, minor, underfunded party very often does not get the support of people who even like the party because they think he's not going to win anyway, he can't have any influence, he's too small, I want to go with the bigger guys. And especially when there's a popular figure like Menachem Begin running, it's very, very hard. So we see the difficulty Rabbi Kahana had. Remember what the billionaires say, the first million is the hardest, earning the first million. However, once Rabbi Kahana got his foot into the Knesset, once he was elected, he took off like a rocket. He shot up in the polls like a rocket. All of a sudden, polls were showing him getting 12 or 15 seats in the next election. There are only 120 seats in the Knesset. So 12 seats would be 10% of the seats in the Knesset. And polls were showing him getting 10, 12, 15 seats, depending on which poll. So you had a situation where the Israeli establishment was panicking. I mean, they were panicking over the prospect of Rabbi Kahana having the third largest party in Israel, because he would have been the third largest party in Israel. He would have been the deciding party in Israel. He would have been the balance of power between the two major parties, the Labor Party and Likud. At that time, it was the Labor Party and Likud were the two big parties. So they were panicking over this. Not only did polls show Rabbi Kahana zoom to the top, not only did they show him getting hundreds of thousands of votes all of a sudden, once he got mass exposure. You know why this happened? Because when he was outside of the Knesset, people couldn't imagine him actually being a Knesset member, actually being victorious. They couldn't imagine it. They thought, this is a guy, we like him, we love what he says, but, you know, he's not going to get anywhere. He's just going against the establishment. It's hopeless. That's what they thought. But once he actually got elected, all of a sudden, it didn't seem that way. Psychologically, for some reason, people suddenly will gravitate to someone when they see that he's actually in the Knesset. He got huge attention in the Knesset. And hundreds of thousands of voters wanted to support him in the next election. Now, the polls not only showed that he was going to get 10 to 12 seats in the 1988 election, which was going to be the next election. The polls also showed that if he got to that point, if he got to the point where he would have a major party and have 12 or 15 seats as a major party, if he had a major party and had 12 or 15 seats, the polls showed that then in the next election in 1992, most Israeli voters told pollsters that at that point they would be willing to actually vote for him to make him prime minister of Israel. That really scared the Israeli establishment, and they were determined to ban him at that point. Now, first of all, here are a couple of questions that come up in relation to this. People may ask, but Chaim, if you run, you know, and if you have a list that runs for the Knesset, even if you get in, if you do also become very popular and become big, aren't they going to try to ban you too? Maybe. Maybe they will. That's possible. But first of all, let me explain what we plan to do to try to avoid getting banned. Rabbi Kahana, in his platform, advocated encouraging the Arabs to leave Israel. But he said if they don't leave voluntarily, that we should force them out. He did favor forcible expulsion of the Arabs who want to destroy Israel. The Arabs are our enemies. They want to destroy Israel. And he said that we should have a program of moving them to the 22 Arab countries that surround Israel. He said the only way that we are ever going to preserve the Jewish state and save the Jewish state from millions of people who are hostile to us and who want to destroy us, the only way we could do this is if we have a program to move the Arabs out, a humane program, but a program to move the Arabs out of the Jewish state, and if they don't leave voluntarily, that we should indeed expel them. Now, the Supreme Court of Israel and the Israeli Knesset, they passed a law called the Anti-Racism Law, where they outlawed what Rabbi Kahana was advocating. And the Supreme Court ruled that you cannot run for the Knesset on the platform that Rabbi Kahana advocated. You can't run on a platform of expelling the Arabs from Israel. Of course, we completely disagree with the ruling. We condemn that ruling. It is anti-democratic. It's an outrage. The Arab parties, by the way, ran on a platform not of expelling the Jews, but of exterminating them. They talk about pushing the Jews into the sea and support Hezbollah and Hamas and Fatah and all the Muslim terrorist organizations that promise genocide against the Jews. That's not racist. That's free speech. That's part of the democratic process. That the Supreme Court said, no, they're allowed to run. Those Arab terrorist parties and terrorist organizations that advocate Israel's destruction and advocate genocide, that's not racist. But when Rabbi Kahana said that we just want to remove the Arabs, not kill them, but just remove them and send them to the 22 very large Arab states that surround Israel, that was deemed racist and he was banned. So it's hypocrisy and it's duplicity and it's a double standard and it's just a complete fraud. It's a politically correct Orwellian fraud, an anti-democratic outrage. That's what took place in Israel. But having said that, following that, the Supreme Court did allow other parties to run on a platform of encouraging the Arabs to leave. The part that Rabbi Kahana originally advocated of encouraging the Arabs to leave, not forcing them to leave, but encouraging them to leave, that the Supreme Court said you are allowed to run on. Gandhi ran on that. Rehavam Ze'evi, whose nickname was Gandhi, he ran on that platform with the Moledit Party. And after that, Michael Kleiner with the Herut Party ran on that platform. The Supreme Court ruled that you can run on a platform saying that you want to encourage the Arabs to leave. In other words, if you offer the Arabs compensation, or if you do other things to encourage the Arabs to leave, to persuade them to leave without forcing them to leave, you're allowed to run on a platform like that. So, if we ran for the Knesset, if our movement in Israel ever runs for the Knesset, which, of course, we're very much interested in trying to get enough funds and get enough support so that we could do so. But if we do, we are going to run on a platform of encouraging the Arabs to leave. Not saying that we're going to force them out, not saying we're going to expel them by force, but encouraging them to leave. So we're going to run on a platform of doing what the Supreme Court has said and has ruled that you're allowed to do. That's our strategy for avoiding getting banned. Now, is it possible that despite that, if we get strong enough, they're still going to want to ban us? Anything is possible. Anything is possible. There are no guarantees of anything in Bolshevik Israel. Anything is possible. But we have to try our best. And again, even if we get to that point, if we get to the point where we become big and we have hundreds of thousands of people who want to support us and then they ban us, at the very least, we'll be able to fight back with a major movement. We will have awakened a lot of people and we'll be in a position at least to continue to fight. Whether it's outside or inside the Knesset, we'll at least be in a strong position. We'll have a big movement by then and we'll become a major force. Of course, our goal will be not to get banned if possible. And I think we have a chance of not getting banned. I think we'd have a reasonable chance. Whether or not they would find some excuse to ban us no matter what we do, that's possible. But if that happens, it's after we've already gotten strong and after we've already become a major force, we're still in a position to influence things one way or the other. Even if they ban us at that point, we're still in a position to actually influence events. So that's very important. So that's not the end of the world. And eventually, we would try to find ways in the next election, the election after that, to get around the ban. We would try to find ways to get around that, which is what Rabbi Kahana was planning to do when he was murdered. And so we're basically doing here, by the way, what Rabbi Kahana was planning to do when he was assassinated by the Al-Qaeda terrorists in 1990. In the 1992 election, he was planning to run a Knesset list and he was planning to run on a platform that was consistent with what the Supreme Court had said you're allowed to run on. He was going to run on a platform similar to the platform of Gandhi. In other words, voluntary transfer, urging the Arabs to leave voluntarily with an offer of compensation rather than forced expulsion. Okay. Now, here's the situation now. Let's understand something, though. Even though Rabbi Kahana was banned, when he became a member of the Knesset in 1984, the country was demoralized when he first came into the Knesset. It had been after the disastrous First Lebanon War, which was a catastrophe for Israel. 1,000 Israeli soldiers were killed for nothing. It was just a disaster. It was a politically correct war where they let soldiers be murdered one after another, and didn't respond because the Arab terrorists were hiding behind Arab civilians, and so they weren't allowed to fire back. I mean, it was a nightmare. And so the country was demoralized. People were very, very depressed. There was a tremendous peace now movement and left-wing movement, and people were saying, let's just do anything. People were so desperate for change, they were willing to try anything, including the solutions of the left. So the situation was terrible when Rabbi Kahana was first elected to the Knesset in 1984. And then during the 4 years that he was in the Knesset with just one seat, he miraculously turned that whole situation around. Rabbi Kahana moved the entire country all the way to the right. He moved the country to the right. When he first came into the Knesset in 1984, people were speaking about, oh, let's just give it all up. Let's just surrender everything. We just can't cope with this anymore. By the time Rabbi Kahana left the Knesset, nobody was speaking about territorial concessions anymore, not even the Labor Party. People had given up on the concept. In fact, Meron Benvenisti, who was the deputy mayor of Jerusalem and who was an advocate of creating a Palestine state and an advocate of surrender, he said, it's too late. There's nothing we can do. It's all over. You know, it was the left that had been demoralized because Rabbi Kahana moved the country to the right. And Rabbi Kahana, in order to try to prevent Rabbi Kahana from taking all their votes away, the Likud government began building tens of thousands of homes for Jews in Judea and Samaria. This was in response to Rabbi Kahana's growing electoral strength. He moved the country to the right. He gave new hope to the people of Israel. He gave new pride to young Israeli Jews. This was a hope that we had for saving Israel. And the Israeli establishment, of course, hated it, every minute of it in the Israeli media. And so they knew that the Arab terrorists, they did know that the Arab terrorists wanted to assassinate Rabbi Kahana. And, you know, they created a situation where he was left unguarded, where he wasn't a Knesset member anymore. I was in prison. I couldn't, you know, I used to, before I went to prison, when I was running the JDL, we always used to check all the people coming into all the speeches of Rabbi Kahana. We used to check everybody. But I was in prison. We didn't have the JDL around. And so Rabbi Kahana continued to go out and speak without that protection because he was determined to bring his message across no matter what. He didn't have anybody to do the things that we used to do when I was running JDL. And so in November 1990, he unfortunately was assassinated by Al-Qaeda terrorists, Yimach Shmam B'Zichram Shem Rasha'im Yirkav. But let's not forget what Rabbi Kahana accomplished. He accomplished a lot. He accomplished a lot historically. He made a big difference during that period of time when he was in the Knesset. And if he had not been assassinated, if he had lived, and if he had not been banned, I believe, by the way, that if he had not been banned, he would have gone on to become prime minister. And we would have had, what a world that would have been if we had a prime minister like Rabbi Meir Kahana in Israel. Oh, what a beautiful world this would have been. But that didn't happen. And so we are going to try to recreate that situation without getting banned and with avoiding some of the pitfalls that occurred with Rabbi Kahana. We're going to try to do that. That's our goal. But we want you to know why. We wanted you to know why it's so important to us that we reach that point. Now, will we shoot up in the polls as fast as Rabbi Kahana did when he was elected? Probably not, because Rabbi Kahana nobody, none of us has the charisma of Rabbi Kahana. We don't. Rabbi Kahana was one in a billion. So we don't have the ability Rabbi Kahana had. But our platform is a platform that does appeal to many people. What we are saying is very sensible. And we do have the potential to get a lot of support. Maybe not as quick. We wouldn't rise as fast as Rabbi Kahana rose, but we would rise. I believe we would rise in the polls. Once we got in, I think we would become a major force. I think we would become a force to be reckoned with once we get our foot in the door. Just as once Rabbi Kahana got his foot in the door, look at all the change he was able to initiate. Look at the incredible positive influence that he had. I think we could have a very positive influence once we get our foot in the door of the Knesset. I believe we would change history. If we got in the Knesset, I believe we would change history. I believe we would change Jewish history. I just want to very briefly say, as far as America is concerned, if Chaim ben Pesach were ever a member of the Israeli Knesset, now right now I'm banned from going to Israel, but if I ever became a member of the Israeli Knesset, and I come back to the United States as a member of the Israeli Knesset, with Fox News and all these other venues now, I mean, then they would put me on, because there'd be a lot of controversy about my being in the Knesset. In a situation like that, I would tell the American people, look, we have a program to save Israel. You should have a similar program to save America. You should be securing your borders. You should be restoring morality in this country. You should be protecting the Second Amendment. And I would go through a whole list of things that America has to do to survive. I believe we could do things that would also be very beneficial to America. And we would, because we would have an alliance with the evangelical Christians and right-wing and conservative Americans. We would work to build an alliance. And if I were in the Israeli Knesset, that would be very realistic. So I think we could have a real positive impact on America as well. A real positive impact. Imagine Chaim ben Pesach on the Sean Hannity show. Imagine Chaim ben Pesach on all these Fox programs. And if I remember the Israeli Knesset speaking on all these programs with my politically incorrect style, but they would put me on politically incorrect or not politically incorrect if I'm an elected official. Now that's newsworthy. If that happened, then I think we could make a difference also. A positive difference also here in the United States. I really believe that that's possible. I think we could have a major alliance with evangelical Christians and conservative and right-wing groups in America. And I think it could lead to very positive things in the United States as well. So that's why this is so much of a dream for us. This would be our dream come true. It's our dream to get into the Knesset, to get the 2% of the vote. We need 2% of the vote is the minimum to get the threshold, to get past that threshold. That's about 75,000. In the last election, it was 75,000 votes, 2%. And in the next election, if you have an increase in voters, it could be 80,000 votes. So we need 75,000, 80,000 votes, something like that. Not easy for a small party with a small budget to do that, but that's our dream. That would be our dream. I don't know if we're going to be able to even run, because I don't know if we'll be ready to run. We're not going to run if it's hopeless, if it's just, you know, we're not going to run if it's hopeless. But if we see that there's a possible chance, even if I'm not in Israel, we'll have people in our movement in Israel running. But if we see there's a chance that there's a possibility, that's our dream. That's our objective. And again, I'm telling you, I really believe this. This I really believe. And you know, I don't just make bloated, giant promises to you. You know, when I honestly tell you when I think things are bad, I've told you honestly over the years that I thought Obama was going to get elected. I mean, when things are bad, I'm honest. When things are good, I'm honest. I honestly believe that if we succeed in somehow getting a Knesset list running, and if we win, if we somehow win, and I admit that we have an uphill battle right now. We have an uphill battle. But if somehow we could win, I honestly believe we will change history. I honestly believe we will change history and have a major impact on events, a major positive impact on events. I really believe that. God willing, it should only happen. So that's our dream. That's our goal. And it's a good goal for Israel and for America. and to also help America as well, because I will certainly speak out on issues of importance in this country, and we will have an alliance with conservatives in the United States if we get into the Knesset in Israel. Anyway, to achieve that goal, what can we do? Well, you know, I mean, obviously we need someone who could give us major funding. I mean, that would be the greatest thing, would be someone who could give us a bank guarantee. If someone could say, I'm going to guarantee $500,000 for your campaign. And as I've said in past shows, how it works is if we win, you don't pay a penny. The Israeli government covers the cost of the campaign. That's how it works. That's Israeli law. If our party gets in, they cover the costs of whatever you guaranteed in the bank guarantee. If we lose, then everything that you put up, you know, whatever was put up, has to be paid over. So you lose the entire amount. So we need people who are wealthy enough to be able to take a risk like that, to take a gamble, hoping that we get in, then it won't cost a penny. But if we don't get in, it has to be understood that means that the money will be lost if we don't get in. Our goal is to find people like that. In the meantime, we want to try to raise as much and achieve as much, and even through the slow process, if we could just somehow get there, you know, this is our dream. This is what we want to do, because we know, I'm telling you, we could do great things if only we could somehow get to that point of getting elected to the Knesset. We could do great things. Right now, if we ran, we don't have enough money. We don't have enough organizational support money. We wouldn't even come close right now. Right now, we wouldn't even come close. So we got a lot of work to do if we're going to get to that point. But that's our dream. That's our goal. And we JTFers, we got to work together and try to achieve that. And so how do you help us? Well, one way to help us is helping us with our videos. When we put up Hebrew and English videos, please like, favorite, comment, mirror the videos on YouTube and on Facebook. Promote the videos on YouTube and on Facebook. The English and the Hebrew videos, even if you don't speak Hebrew. Help us with our videos. That's very important. That gets us exposure. That gets our message across. That's very important. Second, our Facebook pages. We have two English language Facebook pages, and we have one Hebrew language Facebook page. Help us promote those pages. Write messages, especially on the two English language. Those of you that only write in English, please write on the English. Write interesting things. Post interesting messages on the English language Facebook pages. You can also join my personal Facebook page, Chaim Ben Pesach. I have a personal Facebook page in addition to that, so we actually have four Facebook pages if you include my personal Facebook page. And on the English forum, we need people to put up interesting posts and interesting threads on the English forum so that we get thousands of visitors, thousands of people because of all of our videos, because we have so many videos on YouTube now. Thousands and thousands of new people come every single week. Thousands of people come and visit both of our forums, the Hebrew and the English. We want it to look inviting. We want people. Human nature is most people are not the type of people that actually join and start writing and get. Well, that's human nature. Everybody gets involved in their own way. But we want to invite as many people and get as many people active as possible. And so we want the forum to be an inviting, interesting, friendly atmosphere, a good place for people to come, and an interesting and provocative place. Provocative, interesting, but friendly and adult-like. You know, we want that very badly. So let's do that on our English forum. Let's have interesting posts, interesting threads, and make it an inviting place for people. And finally, most of all, of course, we need financial support. That's our biggest problem in terms of wanting to run for the Knesset and do the things we want to do. Our biggest problem is financial. That's our biggest headache. It was Rabbi Kahana's biggest problem as well. And you know, when he got banned, if he had had more money, he would have been able to fight the ban much more effectively. But he didn't have the type of funds. If he had millions of dollars, then he would have been able to really fight the ban much more effectively. In any event, we need all the support we can get. All the support we get makes a big difference. That's why I want to thank our wonderful JTFers who go to JTF.org, our English main page. There's a donate button on top. People go with their credit cards and make donations with their credit cards. They click on the donate button, and it takes just a couple of minutes, or you can go to hayamin.org, our Hebrew main page, also has a donate button on top. And very conveniently, in a couple of minutes, make a donation with a credit card. And equally important, the great JTFers who on a regular basis generously help us with checks and money orders and cash donations. Very, very important. God bless you. God bless all the wonderful JTFers that are helping us. God bless you in this world and in the next world. Let's fight together. I want all of you to be part of this great dream. The Hebrew Forum, the English Forum people, let's all fight to make this dream a reality. If we could just get our message in the Knesset of Israel, in the Parliament of Israel, what a difference. Wow, what a new day that would be for the world. God willing, that day should come. Be'ezrat Hashem, God willing. Okay, now we're going to go to our great questions from our great JTFers. And again, I know I took up a lot of time because I get so enthusiastic when I speak about this issue because this is our dream. This is our dream. Okay, now let's start with our questions from our great JTFers. And we start with the great pyramid head fan who writes, and I quote, "Is it just me or is Sarah Jessica Parker really that ugly?" Unquote. I guess some people think she's ugly. I don't know. I don't think she's especially attractive. I don't think she's especially beautiful. I don't think she's that ugly. I don't know. It's a matter of taste. I guess it's just a matter of taste. I don't like the television program she was on. I think it was immoral, and I think it encouraged immoral behavior. So I don't really like what she stands for. Is she physically ugly? I don't know. I guess it's a matter of taste. Anyway, thank you, Pyramid Head Fan. And now we go to our friend Chicago Jew. Chicago Jew writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, in your opinion, which Hollywood movies that have been made have been the most pro-Jewish?" Unquote. Not many, Chicago Jew. Not many at all. I mean, the Jews in Hollywood are so ashamed to be Jewish, are so self-hating. I mean, can you imagine what great Hollywood movies could have been made about how the Irgun and the Stern Group liberated the land of Israel? I mean, the heroism was so breathtaking. You know, we have movies with James Bond and Mission Impossible and all types of movies of action and thrillers. And in Israel and in Jewish life, those things really happened. Those things really happened in real life, miraculously. 1,000 Irgun underground fighters expelled 100,000 British troops from the land of Israel. 500,000 Jews in the land of Israel, 600,000 Jews in the land of Israel, beat back 7 invading Arab Muslim armies in the 1948 war. In the 1967 war, in 6 days, look what the Jews, in 6 days, Israel quadrupled in size against the whole Arab world. Why doesn't Hollywood do movies about any of this? We know why, because they're afraid of the Muslims, and because they're and also because they're self-hating Jews. There you have Muslim anti-Semitism, and you have Jewish anti-Semitism in Hollywood. That's why. So there are very few. You know, maybe years ago there were some pro-Jewish movies like Exodus. You had a couple of pro-Jewish movies here and there, but not much, very, very little, and certainly nothing compared to the glorious, magnificent, breathtaking movies that should be made of real-life stories of things that really happened. If we ever get into power in Israel, Chicago Jew, you're going to see movies that you'll be proud of. Anyway, thank you for the question. And now we now go to 112. And I'm glad to see you back, 112. It's great to see you back in the Ask JTF section. 112 writes, and I quote, "Obama's in Israel come March. What actions can we take? This is bigger than people knowing. We must act or be the bearer of horrible news," unquote. You're absolutely right. I think the most important thing that we can do I think it's really the only thing we can do is try to wake people up and try to get the Israeli public to be against this, to make clear to the Israeli public that they should oppose any concessions to Obama, that they should be demanding that their leaders destroy Iran's nuclear bomb-making program, and they should be demanding that their leaders not create a so-called Palestine state and not freeze Jewish building, that there should be as much Jewish building in Judea and Samaria, for Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria as possible, and in Jerusalem and in the Golan Heights. We've got to wake the people of Israel up and make them aware and educate them. I think that's the main thing we can do at this point. Anyway, thank you, 112. And now we go to Tag Mechir Tzedek, who writes, and I quote, "One, talk about how the Knesset works both as a whole and within each party as well," unquote. Well, the Knesset has 120 members. It's very, very powerful. It through simple majorities, they can pass laws and create laws and legislate. Now, sometimes the laws are thrown out by the evil left-wing Supreme Court, but the Israeli Knesset has the power. They never did this. They never even dared to even think about doing this, but if we ever had a majority in the Knesset, we would do this. The Israeli Knesset can actually replace the whole Israeli Supreme Court if they wanted to. So the Israeli Knesset legally, technically, has tremendous power. And each party runs in the election. You don't vote for individuals, you vote for the party. You vote for one party in the election. And depending on how many votes that party gets, proportionally speaking, in proportion to the number of votes they get seats in the Knesset. If they get, like, there are 120 seats, so if they get 10% of the vote, they get 12 seats. There is, though, a mandatory minimum of 2%. Before you can get any seats, you've got to get at least 2%, a minimum of 2%. That's the minimum threshold. In Hebrew, it's called Ahuz HaChasima, which means the percent that you need, the threshold percentage that you need. That's basically how it works. And now Tag Mechir writes, and I quote, "Two, is Milchemet Mitzvah a collective, individual objective, or both?" Unquote. Very interesting question, Tag Mechir, and that's a question that Chazal deal with very extensively in the Talmud. Milchemet Mitzvah means obligatory war. What does Judaism say about obligatory wars? Well, first of all, we have to understand that when you speak of obligatory wars, the Gemara, or the Talmud, lists the war against Canaan, in other words, the war to liberate Canaan when the Jews came out of the land of Egypt to liberate the land of Israel. That was an obligatory war. And the war against Amalek. Amalek is the evil, Jew-hating nation that wants to destroy the Jewish people. The Jews are required to defeat and destroy them. The war against Amalek is also an obligatory war. But Harambam, Maimonides, says that there's another obligatory war. He says that there's another commandment where it's clear that there's a commandment that creates another war in which we have to be willing to fight in the war. And that comes from the commandment, Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa means do not stand idly by your brother's blood. If your brother is in trouble, if your fellow Jews are in trouble, you're not allowed to stand by idly. If the Jewish people are in trouble, you have to be willing to fight. That's an obligatory war as well, according to Harambam. That commandment triggers an obligatory war. Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. And so, the question that Tag Mechir asks is this just for an individual? Is an individual required to fight? Is an individual required to do this? Or is this collective? Is this the Jewish people? Is this only for the Jewish people as a whole? As far as an individual is concerned, let me give you an example of what an individual, of a situation where an individual could take a risk to save their fellow Jew. If you see someone drowning, okay, are you required to jump in and save them from drowning? It depends. If there's a good chance that you're going to drown as well, if it's a big risk to your life, you are not required to go in and save them if you may drown as well, if there's a good chance that you may drown as well. You are not required to do it. You're allowed to do it if you want to. but you're not required to do it. You're not required to give your life to save someone else's life. So it depends upon the degree of danger. On the other hand, if there's an overwhelming chance that you won't die, if you could do something where there's only a small chance, a very small chance that there's any danger to you, then you are obligated to do what you have to do to save the person. Then you have to do everything you can to save them. So that's an individual. An individual is required to act depending upon the degree of danger. If there's a major element of danger and the person has to risk their life, as an individual, you are not required. You are not required to risk your life in order to save someone else's life. You can do it, and it's absolutely wonderful and noble if somebody does do it, and you're permitted to do it. You're permitted to risk your life to save someone else's life, but you're not required. You're not obligated to under Torah law. That's an individual. But collectively, the Jewish people are required to risk when it comes to going to war. Because the whole concept of milchemet mitzvah is, you know, if the Torah says that there are wars that are obligatory, then obviously the Torah says that there are times when you're going to have to risk your life, because in wars people die. People get killed in wars. We know that people get killed. So obviously you're risking your life. And when the Torah says you have to go to war, if your fellow Jews are in danger, there's another, you have to go to war. You're not, there's no question, you must go. In a situation like that, that means that collectively, we are required to take those risks. Because if we didn't, we couldn't have an army and we couldn't defend ourselves and we could never survive as a people. So there's a difference between individually and collectively. That's why your question is a very good question. I hope my answer was clear. Anyway, because inherently in war, inherently there's a risk to life. And so, you know, if somebody's going to say, hey, wait a minute, I'm not going to go to war, I'm not going to risk my life, you're not allowed to do that. When the Jewish people are in danger, and when there's an attack on the Jewish people, or when the Jewish people are fighting a war that has to be fought, you're not allowed to say, oh, no, this is not for me, I'm not going to risk my... It's an obligatory war, you're obligated to do it. You're obligated to do it, and it's understood that you're risking your life, that you're doing it even though you're risking your life. So there's a difference between the collective, an obligation when we're acting collectively, and when we're acting individually. Anyway, thank you, Tag Mechir. Okay. And now we go... One second here. And now we go to the great Dr. Dan, the voice of reason, common sense, and logic, who writes, and I quote, please comment on the Woman of the Wall brouhaha that took place at the Kotel recently. Can you do a thoughtful educational JTF video on it? Unquote. Okay, the Kotel is the Western Wall in Jerusalem. And you have these women, these feminists, who go there and deliberately want to go and pray in the section, in the men's section. There's a women's section, there's a men's section. Now, why do men and women pray separately? Not just at the Western Wall, also in the synagogue, in a real synagogue, an Orthodox synagogue. Why is there a mechitza? Mechitza is a separation between the men and the women. Why do they pray separately? It's actually the men's fault. Judaism does not trust men. Judaism actually trusts the women. Judaism trusts the women. Because our experience with women in terms of them not being part of the sin of the golden calf, and they were not part of the sin of the spies going into Israel, the women, and because of righteous women we were redeemed from Israel. So Judaism actually trusts women more than men. But when it comes to sexual issues, Judaism definitely does not trust men. Judaism believes, the reason when we say our prayers, Judaism commands us to pray separately, because if a man is saying his prayers and he's standing around women, maybe standing around women that he's attracted to, he's going to, just by the nature of things, many men are going to be thinking about the women, are going to be thinking about other thoughts other than the prayer. And that we're not supposed to do. We're supposed to try to have as pure and as pure concentration and pure thoughts as we can possibly have when we're saying our prayers. We should try it. We should try at least. Nobody's perfect, but we want to try. Obviously, if you're going to be standing next to a beautiful woman that you're attracted to, obviously, for many men, it's going to be very hard for them to be concentrating on their prayers. That's the reason why. Even a husband and a wife. Husbands love their wives. Husbands are attracted to their wives. A husband should be very attracted to his wife. He has to love his wife. But he shouldn't be thinking about that while he's praying. That's not the time. There's a time and a place for everything. When you're praying, that's not the time for that. When you're praying, you're supposed to be concentrating on what you're saying in the prayer. Now, these women, these feminists, they go to the wall to try to disrupt and to try to force their way into the men's section because they don't want any separation. They're going to force their way, and they're going to say, they say that we want to do all the things that Judaism says that, you know, Judaism has certain functions that women are supposed to do, certain functions men are supposed to do, and men are not better than women, and women are not better than men, but they're different. There are different functions because men and women are different. It's one is not better than the other. One is definitely not superior or inferior. No way. You may even argue that women are superior. I don't know. I know a lot of people that might think that from life experiences. But seriously, Judaism doesn't consider one sex to be superior or inferior to the other. But we each have different functions. And so these feminists, they want to take the fun, they want to be female so-called rabbis, and they don't want Orthodox Judaism, and they want to do everything that's disruptive and against the Torah. And they're rebelling against the Torah. And so they 10 of them were arrested at the wall. They should be arrested because what they're doing is disorderly and disruptive, and they're infringing upon the rights of people who go to that wall with the intention of praying in the men's section. They shouldn't be doing that. And so, you know, this is something that should be stopped and they should be arrested. And I would take very strong action against them. I would make sure that they learn their lesson. I would throw them in prison and keep them there for a couple of weeks to teach them a lesson, because these are traitors to the Jewish people. These women are individuals who want to encourage massive numbers of people to defy Judaism and to act against the Jewish faith. And that is truly evil. You know, it's one thing when someone sins themselves. If a person by himself sins, it's bad. It's very bad. It's something not to be encouraged. It's very, very bad. But there's one thing when someone sins by himself. There's another when someone encourages many others to sin. When someone goes out to the public and tries to encourage everybody to sin, that's really evil. That is really bad. And that's what these women are doing. That's what these women are trying to do. And so, you know, I think what they're doing is terrible. I agree with you that it would be a good subject for a video eventually. It's something to think about. Maybe we should eventually do a video on it. It is certainly a worthy subject. Anyway, thank you very much, Dr. Dan. And now we go to the great Waiting for the Mother Plane to Come, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, please talk about Mia Love, the GOP congressional candidate from Utah. Was she the real deal or a phony, unquote. Waiting for the Mother Plane, I don't know. I don't know enough about her. I know that she's a black woman from Brooklyn who converted to Mormonism and then moved out to Utah and then ran for mayor of the city in Utah, and she's a mayor of a city, and then she ran for Congress. Last November she ran for Congress, and she came very close. She lost, but she came very close to winning. Is she a righteous black conservative or is she a phony? I don't know. I honestly don't know the answer. I can tell you one thing. She's a Mormon, and I don't want to... I do not want to offend Mormons. There may be Mormons who, and we do sometimes, by the way, we do sometimes get support from Mormons. I mean, I have actually gotten letters supporting us from people in from from Mormons in Utah and Idaho. Not many, but we've gotten three or four over the years. So I don't want to offend good people. They're decent people who may be Mormons, but my preference would be in America would be for evangelical Christian candidates, because the evangelicals, from my perspective, they are the ones who are really, really sincerely believe in the Bible and believe in Israel and believe in the things that I think are important in terms of morals. I'm not saying the Mormons don't, that the Mormons are bad. I'm not saying that. But if we're looking for righteous candidates, that would be my preference. I think the evangelicals are preferable, in my opinion. You know that I supported Mike Huckabee, even though I don't like his positions on certain issues. Certain things he did as governor of Arkansas I didn't like, but, you know, he's in Israel right now, Mike Huckabee. And this is, I think, his 19th trip to Israel. And he is so pro-Israel. He could run on our Knesset list. He could run, and he would be comfortable running on our Knesset list with the platform he's taken on issues involving Israel. So I love Mike Huckabee. I mean, I think that would be a dream come true if he ever became president. Anyway, so my answer, unfortunately, is I just don't know enough to say. I honestly don't know enough about her. But anyway, thank you, Waiting for the Mother Plane. And now we go to the great Kalman Ben Menachem, who writes, and I quote, "Chaim, when a woman marries, does she follow her husband's minhag or her father's?" Thank you, unquote. The answer is she's supposed to follow her husband's minhag. When she lives in her father's house, when she's growing up, when she's a young lady and she's growing up in her father's house, she should follow her father's minhag. But when she moves in with her husband, she should follow her husband's minhag. Minhag is his custom. That means the custom, the way he prays, because you have different customs and ways of praying and doing various things. They're not huge differences, but there are differences between, like, the way the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim and various other groups pray. But it is the rule, the halachic rule is that the woman follows the husband's minhag, the husband's customs. Anyway, thank you, Kalman. And now we go to Mr. VSS, who writes, and I quote, "Chaim, please educate, enlighten, and inform about the British Kinder Transport Program," unquote. Okay, it just so happens that I know someone who's a friend of my mother, who was part of that program. He's almost 90 years old now. He and his wife are friends of my mother. He was from Austria. What happened was, after the Kristallnacht attack — Kristallnacht was an attack in 1938 in which Jewish synagogues, businesses, stores, homes were brutally attacked by the Nazis in Germany. And because of all the smashed glass, because they smashed the glass of every Jewish store, every synagogue, all the homes, there was so much glass all over the streets that they called it Kristallnacht, the Crystal Night. In other words, the night of the crystals, the broken glass. And they also murdered Jews. Jews were murdered in those attacks. It was a pogrom. And after that, British Jewish leaders went to the British Prime Minister and to the British Parliament and asked that they begin a program to bring in at least the children from Germany, Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, to bring in children from these countries in order to save the children from Nazi persecution. And so Britain did agree to a small program of bringing in almost 10,000 Jewish children, almost 10,000 children. Not all of them were Jewish, but most of them were Jewish. Almost 10,000 children were brought into England in order to save them from Nazi persecution. I don't give the British a lot of credit for this at all, and I'll tell you why. Because later on, the same British closed the doors not only to England but to the land of Israel, to the more than 6 million Jews who were murdered in the Holocaust. If they had just allowed those Jews to escape into the land of Israel, they could have prevented the entire Holocaust. So the British have responsibility for the Holocaust. They definitely had a hand in the Holocaust, a very evil hand in the Holocaust. But there's an interesting moral to this story. When British Jewish leaders decided to intervene, look, they got results. Look at how they got results. You know what this proves? This proves that British Jewish leaders and American Jewish leaders had intervened in the Holocaust. Think of how many Jews could have been saved. You see this? A delegation of British Jewish leaders went and made a request. Almost 10,000 Jewish children were saved because of that. Can you imagine if they had consistently began a campaign to save the Jews during the Holocaust, what British Jewry and American Jewry could have done? This just accentuates the gravity of the crime of American Jewish silence and British Jewish silence and inactivity and apathy and indifference during the Holocaust. What a terrible crime. And the same American Jews now vote for Obama and are guilty of betraying Israel. That's a terrible, terrible sin. One thing JTF does do is JTF gives American Jews an opportunity not to be part of that apathy and indifference and to fight loyally for the survival of Israel. That's one thing JTF does offer American Jews. And I think that that's very important. Anyway, thank you very much, Mr. VSS. And now we go to the great ex-Muslim who writes, and I quote, "What do you think about Donald Trump and his latest lawsuit against Bill Maher for $5 million, unquote? Okay, I don't know if everybody's familiar with what happened here. Bill Maher, Donald Trump said that he would give $5 million to charity if Barack Hussein Obama would release his college transcripts or his college records, because Barack Hussein Obama had lousy grades and got into Harvard through affirmative action because of his race. If Barack Hussein Obama had been white, he wouldn't have gotten into any college because his grades stunk, because he was a lousy student. And Donald Trump knows this. So Donald Trump said, if you release your college transcripts, I will give $5 million to any charity that you pick. That's what he said. Okay, so Bill Maher responded and said, I'll give $5 million if Donald Trump can prove that his father is not an orangutan. Okay, so Donald Trump said, you want to know something? I can prove my father was not an orangutan. I want you to give the $5 million to a charity that I pick because I can prove it. So Donald Trump is suing him for it now. Now, Bill Maher is refusing to do it. By the way, Bill Maher gave $1 million to Obama's reelection campaign and raised a lot of money for Obama and out of his own pocket gave a $1 million check to Obama's reelection campaign. And Bill Maher is a self-hating Jewish pig, the lowest type of pig on the face of the earth. And by the way, you know, he refers to Donald Trump's father as an orangutan. What would happen if someone in Hollywood or some comedian had said that Barack Hussein Obama's father is an orangutan? I think Barack Hussein Obama's father is an orangutan. In fact, I think it's an insult to orangutans. Have you ever seen Barack Hussein Obama's father? I think it's an insult to orangutans. But nobody would ever dare say that. But you're allowed to say it about anybody. You're allowed to say about what you want about Romney or about Donald Trump or about Republicans and conservatives. That you're allowed to trash as much as you want. But if you dare say something like that about Obama, you know what the response is going to be. By the way, just to show you what scum Bill Maher is. Bill Maher said on his show that he agrees with Chuck Hagel that Israel controls the United States government, that Israel controls the Congress and controls the United States, that the Israelis are telling America what to do. In other words, Bill Maher agrees with the anti-Semitic Nazi comments of Chuck Hagel. Chuck Hagel spoke about the Jews the way Hitler and the Germans, the way Hitler and the Germans spoke about the Jews, the German Nazis in Nazi Germany. The Jews control everything. This is the way the Nazis speak. And that's what Chuck Hagel, Chuck Hagel is a Nazi, that's why he said that. Bill Maher said he agrees with that. Bill Maher, the self-hating Jew, agrees with Chuck Hagel's anti-Semitic Nazi comments about the Jews controlling everything. I mean, what a hideous, filthy, low-life swine. Anyway, thank you, ex-Muslim, for the question. And that's my view of Bill Mayer and Donald Trump. That's what I think of this whole thing. And now we go to Tselhar, who is very active on both the English and the Hebrew forums. Tselhar writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, what is the JDO and who is Jared Taylor against whom they are rallying in Tennessee, unquote. Okay. The JDO is a breakaway, the crazy Mordechai Levy formed an organization because the JDL threw him out. First, he was working with Irv Rubin, which would have been appropriate because the two of them were two of a kind. But anyway, he formed this group. He's completely insane. He's completely nuts. It's a one-man organization. He says he's going to have a demonstration again. He's going to be rallying in Tennessee. It's all Mordechai Levy. It's all fantasy. It's complete fantasy, complete nonsense. Mordechai Levy is completely nuts. Mordechai Levy did everything he could to sabotage our campaign to save Soviet Jewry when I was running the JDL. He literally tried to sabotage our campaign to save Soviet Jews. He condemned Rabbi Kahana and called him a racist. He called me a racist. He condemned us when we did the tear gassing at the Moseyev Ballet, at the Soviet Ballet. He condemned us. He called me a terrorist. I mean, he did everything possible, the dirtiest things you can imagine, to try to sabotage our campaign to save Soviet Jews. So it's a hideous organization, but fortunately it's an organization with really just one active person, Mordechai Levy. Anyway, thank you. So, and by the way, Jared Taylor is a bad guy. He's a guy who invites David Duke to these conferences. So he is a bad guy. But Mordechai Levy, he's looking for issues here. And it's just, the whole thing is just ridiculous. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. Instead of rallying in Tennessee, the state of Israel and the Jewish people are in grave danger. We're facing a threat to our very survival. And he's worried about this guy in Tennessee that's holding this conference that nobody even pays attention to. Anyway, thank you, Tselhar, for the question. And now we go to the Noachide, who writes, and I quote, I request JTF to do a video debunking the cult group called the Black Hebrew Israelites, unquote. No question, it's a subject that is worthy of a video. I hope that, it's something for us to keep in mind. It's something we should keep in mind, the possibility of doing a video. I think it would be an interesting video. I've seen some videos on the Black Hebrew Israelites on YouTube. I mean, the viciousness of how they curse at women. You know, they stand on the streets in New York City and curse at all the women going by and call them sluts and curse at people and say they're going to kill people. I mean, this is just incredible. And they're allowed to get away with this? You know, first of all, this is making threats, aggravated harassment, disorderly conduct. These are all crimes. You're not allowed to do that. I mean, these people on camera are committing criminal acts. And, you know, so I'm amazed that they're allowed to get away with this. I'm not really amazed because, we all know how these things work. But, you know, it's really an outrage. It really is. And there are many videos against them already on YouTube. Should we do a video also? I think it's a worthy subject. It's something for us to keep in mind as a possible worthy subject. Absolutely. Anyway, thank you very much, the Noachide. Thank you very, very much. And now we go to the great Kahana loyalist who writes, and I quote, Dear Chaim, Egypt is in complete economic and societal collapse. Do you think Egypt will cease being a threat as a result of the Brotherhood takeover, unquote? No, absolutely not. I agree that they're facing economic and societal collapse, but it's still a country with 80 million people seething with hatred on Israel's southern border and with the most advanced American weapons and American technology. It's absolutely a continuing threat. To say that little Israel with 5.5 million Jews should not feel threatened by a country of 80 million people on her border, that is a nation that is sworn to destroy Israel, obviously that's a tremendous threat. We can't pretend that threat is going to disappear. When the Mashiach comes, it's going to disappear. But this is a continuing threat. There's no question what's happening there now. The crisis there now. That's a good thing. I'm glad that's happening. But we can't pretend that Egypt is not a continuing threat. It is a threat. There's no question. It's a threat. And you know, there's always a danger that Egypt will begin a nuclear program as well. That Egypt will begin a program to develop nuclear bombs. That's always also a danger. Let's hope the Egyptian economy continues to be in the tank so that they're unable to do it. I hope, God willing, that continues to be the case. But the possibility of them recovering and uniting quickly and quickly getting their act together to make war against Israel again, that possibility is very real. And believe me, there will be war with Egypt again in the future. That will eventually happen again. Anyway, thank you, Kahana Loyalist. And now we go to the great Manch, who writes, and Manch, it's always great to see you. Manch writes, and I quote, "Chaim, this week my wife gave birth to a beautiful and healthy baby boy." Oh, that's wonderful, Manch. I'm so happy to hear that. What wonderful news. Baruch Hashem, thank God. That's wonderful news. And now Manch writes, his name is Ariel Felix, middle name, Ben Yigal. Please bless him. My pleasure, Blan. My pleasure, Manch. My pleasure. Shehakadosh Baruch Hu yevarech et Ariel Felix Ben Yigal. Im kol habrachot, gam ba'olam hazeh ve'gam ba'olam haba. Shehakadosh Baruch Hu yishmor alav. Amen. Ken yehi ratzon. Absolutely, Manch. That's wonderful news. I'm so happy. I'm so happy to hear that. And I'm so happy that you have this happiness that was brought into your life. I'm so happy to see this. Thank you. Thank you so much. You made me happy, Manch. I love seeing news like this. You made me happy. Thank you, Manch. And now we go to the great Ephraim ben Noach, who writes, and I quote, "Could you talk a little about the relationship of Hiram and Solomon?" By the way, I said Hiram because that's the Hebrew way of saying it, even though it's Hiram. I don't know how you say it in English. I guess Hiram. But Ephraim wants me to speak about Hiram and Solomon, which is in the book of Kings, chapter 5, verse 9 to chapter 6. I think there might be some importance there, unquote. Absolutely, Ephraim. There is a lot of importance in that story. Hiram was the king of Tsur in Hebrew. In Hebrew, it's called Tsur. In English, it's Tyre, which is a city in southern Lebanon. But it was a kingdom. It was a kingdom, and he was called Hiram Melech Tsur, which means Hiram, the king of Tsur. And we, in English, sometimes we refer to him as the king of the Phoenicians. And he had an alliance with Shlomo HaMelech. Shlomo HaMelech is King Solomon. He had a lot of cedar wood. He had really great experts at creating stone and wood creations. And so he helped with the building of the temple, the building of the first temple, the Beit HaMikdash, the first temple in Jerusalem. Shmo gave him, in exchange, 20 cities in the Galilee, in the Galil, for trade, where he could do trade. 20 cities in the land of Israel where he could do trade, and gave him many other trade deals, and gave him food and cattle for his people. And he actually was greatly enriched by the relationship as well with Shlomo, with Solomon. But they had a long-standing trade relationship and a long-standing alliance. And they worked together to create the Holy Temple, and it was an alliance that was beneficial to both peoples and both nations. Anyway, thank you very much, Ephraim. And now we go to Say No to Islam, who writes, and I quote, "Do you think it's sad that meteorite that recently fell in Russia didn't wipe out their entire evil Nazi country?" Unquote. Say no to Islam. You never hold back any punches. No, I think you're great, and I know you never hold back anything. there's no question that Russia traditionally has been a very anti-Semitic and anti-American country, and a country that has done terrible things in the world. It's the truth. Right now, they're the main source of arming and technology for Iran, for Iran's nuclear bomb-making program. They're doing terrible, terrible damage to the world. And this is something Russia has done for many years. For centuries, they murdered the Jews. They slaughtered Jews, persecuted Jews, tortured Jews for centuries. They used to have a law in Russia where Jews would be drafted into the army and would have to serve for 25 or 30 years. The Russian non-Jews wouldn't have to serve for 20. They would serve for 2 years, 3 years. But the Jews would be required to serve for 25 or 30 years just because they were Jewish. Jews used to mutilate themselves. They used to cut their fingers off and mutilate themselves so they wouldn't be drafted into the army. That's how much Jews wanted to avoid the nightmare of spending their entire life until they became old men in a horrible, miserable army with the worst conditions possible. Russians did terrible things to the Jewish people for centuries. Terrible, terrible things. And to this day, they're doing everything they can to hurt Israel, everything they can to help Iran build nuclear bombs, everything they can to undermine America and to work against America. It's a very cruel and evil country. But judgment will come to Russia, and judgment will come, you know, judgment comes to every country that does, that engages in these types of behaviors. If I will bless them that bless thee, curse them that curse thee. We saw what happened to the Soviet Union. And Russia is getting, little by little, is getting her payment now. Little by little. Anyway, thank you very much. Say no to Islam. And now we go to the great Maimonides, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, do you believe that Senator Rand Paul can ever be trusted not to be an enemy of Israel? Unquote. Absolutely not. Senator Rand Paul is an enemy of Israel. He is the same as his father, except he's a more clever version of his father. You know, he'll visit Israel and he'll claim that he's not against Israel, and he won't make the type of statements his father made on Iranian television. His father went on Iranian television and compared Israel to the Nazis and basically said Israel should be destroyed. And his father, you know, is a Nazi. His father actually accepts money from the owner of the Stormfront and from Nazis. He accepts contributions and refused to return the contributions. So, I mean, his father is a Nazi. Rand Paul, though, managed his father's campaign and was active in his father's campaign and supported his father. And you see that he agrees with his father. It's just a more clever presentation of the same positions as his father. There's no difference. He is an enemy of Israel and an enemy of the Jewish people. And he's also a disaster for America. Anyway, thank you, Maimonides. And now the great Confederate Kahanist writes, and I quote, Dear Chaim, have you heard of this former LAPD cop Chris Dorner, unquote? Well, obviously I have. I think we all have. He's the black cop from Los Angeles who murdered four people and then committed suicide, fortunately. I mean, just a hideous individual. And, you know, this is what happens when you give people jobs, especially cops, especially police officers, people that are armed and trained and have badges and have legal power. You give this to affirmative action scum like this, this is what happens. I mean, this is the result. You know, we recently had, this isn't the police department, but this bugs me. The fire department in New York City, about 6 months ago, the fire department in New York City was ordered by a federal judge to hire hundreds of black applicants who applied for the fire department and who failed the test. There was a test of the fire department. They failed the test. And the federal judge ruled and ordered the city to hire the failed black applicants over white applicants who passed the test. In other words, the whites who passed the test are not going to be hired. The blacks who failed the test are going to be hired. I mean, this is the most racist, vicious type of rulings. I mean, these rulings are so racist and so vicious, it's beyond the pale. And look at how lives are being endangered by this. These are going to be the firemen. If there's a big fire and people and children and people's lives are in danger, we're going to have these affirmative action morons who can't even pass a test, who don't even know how to read. They're going to be the firemen. They couldn't even read. They did not have basic skills even. They are morons. And they are being hired by court order. While the white applicants who passed the test, who did well on the test, are not going to be hired. Now let me make very clear. I am against any racial discrimination in hiring. I believe that when you give a test, you should hire people solely based upon qualification. If someone is qualified, if someone is good for the job, you hire them. You don't pay attention to someone's race. Their race should be irrelevant. But to hire people solely based upon the fact that they're black, and this has been going on now for 50 years, and yet black leaders like Barack Hussein Obama tell us that there's racism against blacks. Racism against blacks? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? We have affirmative action quota programs in this country in place for more than 50 years already. Not only the government, but the private sector. Everyone has been doing this. You get into trouble with the government, with the EEOC, and all these other government agencies if you do not hire a certain number of what they call minority applicants. I mean, it's an outrage. This is no longer a free country. When someone comes to a private business and says, you must hire someone of a certain race, whether you like it or not, and even if they're unqualified, you have to hire them. Even if they're much less qualified, you have to hire them. What type of country have we become? And look at the consequences. Look who's sitting in the White House now. It's not just in the police department, the fire department. In the White House, we have the same situation. Someone who's grossly unqualified is sitting in the White House now and has just been elected to a second term as president. Anyway, thank you, Confederate Kahanist. And I want to thank all of our great JTFers for another show that I enjoy doing. Until next week, Shalom.